This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 48 of What's It Like. My guest is John Hinchey. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm fantastic, Ken. Thanks for asking.
And you're in Nashville, Tennessee?
I am in Nashville, Tennessee as we speak.
Surviving the weather?
Oh, it's for Nashville, it's brutally hot lately.
Did you grow up in Nashville?
I did not. I am a native Bostonian. I grew up in a suburb of Boston called Stoneham, probably most famous for being the hometown of Nancy Kerrigan.
Yes.
Besides myself, of course. I grew up there until I graduated high school, and I still have family back there. I still visit when I can.
Did you come from a large family?
I have one younger sister. That's it.
So not too big. Yeah.
So just two of us.
So who had the greatest influence on your life when you were growing up?
Early on, my dad, my mom and dad, of course, and we had a next door family that we were very close mm-hmm. to, and the father of that family, Ed Carroll. I also think that he was very influential on me. I had a very good relationship with that family, but particularly with Ed. Mm-hmm. My dad was a machinist, worked for General Electric, making parts for aircraft engines.
Oh.
At the time, you know, it was the 70s, so airplane engines for Vietnam, you know, for the war effort, and parts for the space program. He was not college educated, but a very intelligent man, great with his hands, great with, you know, anything that took details, and very funny, your typical kind of New England, northeastern Boston Irishman.
What was your major challenge as a child?
I think probably that I was not particularly athletic. I was a kind of skinny kid. And where I grew up, sports were very big. If you know anything about Boston, they're really big on their sports franchises. There was a little bullying. I was probably a little easy to pick on. But I had a sense of humor that saved my saved my bacon on more than one occasion.
So. So you could talk your way out of things?
Generally, yes. And as I got older into junior high and high school, I was kind of able to associate with a lot of different groups, whether it was the athletes or the guys who were getting in trouble all the time, or the musicians or the nerds. I could kind of float from all those different groups due to a little bit to my sense of humor, I think. I discovered music fairly early on. My favorite story to tell about that is that, you know, the band director from the high school came to the elementary school where I was and demonstrated all the instruments. And I ran home to my mother and she said, well, what instruments did they have? And I said, well, I want to play the drums. And she said, no, what other instruments did they have? At the time was lamenting the fact that he had almost no maybe one or no trombone players at the high school level. And boy, we'd really like to get more trombones. And my mother said, that sounds great. You can go, And that, coupled with the fact that there was a trombone floating around the neighborhood families that no one was using at the time, that three or four other people had started in, I got my first trombone.
Wow. My story is sort of the opposite. I'm an albino, so I have lousy eyes.
Uh-huh.
So when I went to band, I wanted to play trumpet, but 1,000 other kids wanted to play trumpet too.
Of course,
and so they said, well, no, you shouldn't do that because it's going to be really hard on you. And so what else could you play? And they said, so how about drums? And they said, yay! So that's what we went for.
you got to be Ringo and I didn't. So.
That's right. See, just the opposite. There we go. Was there a particular childhood experience that most contributed to who you are today?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I actually can't think of one defining factor. I will say that I generally think I had a really good, safe childhood, a happy childhood, and, you know, really great memories of family mm-hmm. and friends. So,
did you always want to be a musician?
I wanted to be a hockey player. I love my Boston Bruins, still do, and they won the Stanley Cup this year after many, many years of not having done so. I loved playing hockey when I was a kid, but I was terrible at it. As I told you, I was not very athletic, but there are early pictures of me just learning to walk and my dad holding a hockey stick with me holding my hands up, you know, skating on a pond behind our house. And I used to play till it was too dark to see on the ponds, and then we'd play street hockey. And that's what I wanted to do at first. I really wanted to be a hockey player. And I just wasn't – everybody wanted to be a hockey player where I grew up, you know. And so there was stiff competition, and I really wasn't cut out for that. And so then I kind of got into music because it just seemed to be something that I, you know, I started with a little interest in playing trombone, and I actually was pretty good at it. So
what did you do after high school?
After high school, I went to Towson. It was actually Towson State Teachers College when I first went there. Then it changed to Towson University while I was there, Towson State University, and now it's Towson University. It's in Baltimore. It's actually in Towson, Maryland, which is just right next to Baltimore. And I went there because the jazz band director at the time was a fellow named Hank Levy, and he wrote for the Stan Kenton Orchestra and the Don Ellis Orchestra. And my high school band director, I had a band director who came in when I was a sophomore who really shook the program up. The guy had been there for years, retired, and this new guy came in named Tony Hyde, and he was young and hip and had long hair and went to had gone to Berklee School of Music, and we thought that was all just so cool. And our high school marching band had 16 people in it when he arrived, and six of us were trombone players.
A strong section.
Yes, it certainly was. But, you know, there was like two trumpets, a flute, a clarinet, and he put flag girls on the end of the band so we'd look like something coming out on the field. Now, bear in mind, up in Massachusetts, this whole marching band phenomenon isn't what it's like in other parts of the country, or wasn't at the time. I talked to friends of mine, and they said, oh, we had 200 people in our marching band. You know, but, you know, there was a respectable number in most of the towns, you know, 50 or so. But anyways, he came in, and the way he got the program jump started was he said, I'm going to start a stage band. That's what we called, you know, the high school jazz bands back then. And Tony Hyde, much to his credit, started a stage band and started exposing myself and everybody else to all these great people like Maynard Ferguson and Stan Kenton and Buddy Rich. And it was the closest thing previous to that. You know, what really got me excited about music was hearing Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Because the first thing I heard was the Beatles. I remember seeing the Beatles and Ed Sullivan, and we were all really excited. But, you know, there was no trombones in the Beatles.
That's true.
And I kept thinking, oh, wow, it's no trombones in the Beatles. And then Chicago came along, Jimmy Pankow, their amazing trombone player, who trailblazer at what he did. And, you know, I thought, wow, this is really great. And then Tony Hyde started introducing me to all these, you know, to big band and all the jazz elements. So what I really wanted to be after the hockey thing was the trombone player for Chicago. You know, that's really what I wanted to do. And the avenue through that, you know, even Berklee at the time didn't really have commercial music in that they weren't teaching rock. Most of the schools at the time were teaching jazz. But anyways, Tony played for me the Towson State College album, known as the Yellow Album to people who were into that sort of thing. And Hank Levy had written these arrangements, and we played one of them, and it was in 7/4. And Hank was known for writing in exotic meters, as he called it. He would write in 9/4 and 7/4 and 5/4 and 13/4. We played a piece in 25 when I was there. And if you're familiar with the Don Ellis Orchestra, he was quite tied in with Don, and Don was doing a lot of that sort of thing at the time. And Stan Kenton was a big advocate of Hank's, and they did several albums of his music with some of his music in the odd meters. So anyways, I heard that, and it's funny, the deciding factor on where I went to college was my dad says, well, if you go to Lowell University, which is right down the street in Boston, and get your degree in music ed, you can have a car. But if you go out of state, you know, you can live at home and have a car. But you can go to an out-of-state school, but we're not going to be able to get you a car. And I started thinking, living at home and having a car or living on campus, I thought, yep, I'm out of here. I applied to several universities and UMass and ULL, some fine schools. My parents insisted that I get a music education degree to have something to fall back on. And, you know, at the time, in the back of my mind, I always knew that that probably was not where I was going to end up. But, you know, they had a music ed degree at Towson, and they had a fine trombone teacher. Another big influence of mine in high school was my trombone teacher named John Coffey, who among brass players of that era was a very well-known brass teacher. Famous trumpet player Bill Chase studied with him. Don Ellis, the trumpet player I mentioned earlier, studied with Dave Bergeron, the trombone player from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, studied with him, plus all these famous symphonic trombone and tuba players and trumpet players that studied with him. And I was very fortunate to study with him. And a student of his taught trombone at Towson, where I ended up going. So between Hank Levy and John Mellick, who was the trombone teacher there, it was just kind of, and the tuition was just absolutely fabulous. It was right in the wheelhouse for my parents. So off to Baltimore I went.
And the rest is history.
Oh, my four-year degree took me 5 years because, in my four and a half years, I collapsed my left lung in my trombone teacher's office. I was playing a 12-tone trombone solo that I was to perform with the trombone ensemble in a few weeks. And I've sworn off 12-tone music since then. And I'm sure music people will kind of get the joke about that. But it's very esoteric type of music. And anyways, yeah, I was in my trombone teacher's office and I felt like I had some congestion and I was having trouble breathing. And I said to him, you know, I think I'm going to go down to the health center and see what's going on. He said, great, I'll see you at rehearsal later. He walked out his office door, went to the right. I walked out his office door, went to the left, took about 10 steps and collapsed in the hallway. He was gone. I'm in the hallway all by myself. And another trombone student walked up and said, you look terrible. And I said, yeah, I know. I can't breathe. I feel like somebody's driven a stake through my chest. And he said, I bet you have a collapsed lung. I had never heard of such a thing. I have no idea how this guy knew. It was my friend Bob Israel, who now runs Blues Alley Jazz Club in Washington, D.C., by the way. And I just reconnected with him on Facebook after 30 years and thanked him again for saving my life. But yeah, they summoned the ambulance and off I went, and it turned out it had a 60% collapse of my left lung. And it's known as a spontaneous pneumothorax. Don't ask me to spell it. It just happens, and apparently it's very common with tall, thin men between the ages of 19 and 22 or 23, and usually horn players and athletes. And I was right in the, you know, right in ground zero for all that. I'm trying to remember, I think I was 20 at the time. You know, trombone player, obviously, and it happened in December. And they took me into the hospital, wheeled me in, and the doctor said, gee, I don't know, and I think we're going to have to do operation. I said, can't you give me a pill or something? I got a gig tonight. I had a big band gig that night, but he said, no, I think you're going to be here a little while. So there's a whole long story involved like with that, but let me bring it down short. They did a kind of a temporary fix, and the day after Christmas, I was able to drive back up to Boston. And then spring break after that, which was April or March at the time, this was 1978, I guess, I had another minor collapse of the lung. So they did a pleurectomy where they actually take away the pleura, part of the covering of the my left lung. And so normally your air sacs adhere to the pleura adheres to the chest cavity. So now my air sacs kind of adhere just to the chest cavity. My left side, I tell people I'm the bionic trombone player. We can make him play higher, faster, and louder than he could before. They did an operation. And so I was off playing trombone for, close to 6 months. And during that time is when I decided to look into this whole arranging thing. And, you know, I was there with Hank, and I had started taking some arranging lessons, but I hadn't spent a lot of time on it, but I had a lot of time to focus on it since I had to take a semester off from playing. You know, it's one of those kind of lemonade, things. Life hands you lemons, you make lemonade. I really got into arranging and I really dug into it and I found that I had a knack for it as well as a bit of a passion for it. And so that ended up starting, you know, that other branch of the tree to my career, which is definitely the more lucrative part of my career at this point.
So what do you actually do?
Okay. God, you sound like my wife. I would say that I am a musician / arranger. And I'm also a producer, like a lot of people that you probably run into in my business, especially in the year 2011, you wear a lot of different hats to make a living in this business, unless you are absolutely at the pinnacle of one of the professions. I work as a trombone player, but my main thing that people hire me for is to arrange, orchestrate, some composing, and producing. And producing meaning that somebody has a project where they have music and they need somebody to handle all the details of delivering onto them a music product at the end.
Is there a particular genre that you work in?
Genre, as far as type of music, no. Industry, yes. The entertainment industry, which I do a lot of work for cruise lines, different cruise lines, Norwegian Cruise Lines, Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines, and I've worked for a score of others. Theme parks, did a lot of work for it was originally called the King's Productions family of theme parks, who are bought Great America in Northern California at one point, where I met Ed Goldfarb, who we talked about earlier, and King's Island in Cincinnati, King's Dominion in Virginia, Carowinds, Canada's Wonderland in Toronto. There was an Australian park they had at one point. So anyways, through the years, for the last 25 plus years, I've done a lot of work for cruise ships, theme parks, kind of song and dance stuff, you know, if there's people on stage and they're performing Vegas style production shows, some people may, you know, equate them to. In the last 10, you know, years or so, or probably 15 years or so, I, I kind of tried to break away from that for a while and got more into working in the commercial music industry, commercial meaning working with artists for music for their CD projects or whatever. So that I'll get hired on kind of as a specialist to write horn and string arrangements. I've done 5 of Sting's Rainforest benefit concerts where they have like this all-star band and he's raising money to raise awareness about the rainforest. And every year they pick a different theme. Actually, they do it every 2 years. And the last one was music of the 80s. And Sting will line up all these stars like Lady Gaga and Elton John and Bruce Springsteen and Deborah Harry, and the list goes on and on. And they will sing music from the 80s. So you've got Bruce Springsteen singing Don't Stop Believin', you know, by Jury, that sort of thing. And it's a big, you know, it's $2,500 a seat to go to this thing, and it's a big money raiser. So anyways, something like that. They'll have somebody who takes care of what the rhythm section plays, and then they'll call in, they called in my buddy Jim Horn, who's a very famous sax player, to kind of be in charge of the horn arrangements. And when he got overloaded with work, the first one of these he did, he called me in. We're friends. We work on a lot of projects together. And so we will write just what the horn section plays. And, if an artist writes a song and they have, you know, beautiful song with the vocals and the rhythm section arrangement, and they say, gee, it'd sound great if there was some strings backing this up to lift it to another level, they bring in somebody like myself who's done especially that part of the process to write special horn and string arrangements for that. But I also do vocal arranging and using synthesizers for all the other type of sounds you might hear. And I'm kind of the guy who puts a lot of the icing on the cake.
What's the best thing about your job?
The best thing? I would say that I just, the variety, the sheer variety of what I do amazes me. In January, I was in Abbey Road Studios in London, England, with a 48-piece orchestra playing my arrangements. And I came back and I was writing arrangements of pop music using all synthesizers for an amusement park in upstate New York called Playland. So that people could sing and dance. They wanted me to do a mashup. And a mashup, for the people who don't know, a medley is when you take two tunes and you kind of do one after the other. And there's something on a mashup. You take the two tunes and you squash them on top of each other. And they wanted me to do a mashup of Bohemian Rhapsody and Great Balls of Fire. So I have to figure out a way. It's like a great puzzle, figuring out a way where those two tunes will intersect and where I can do something clever that makes you laugh or make you go, and still work. So a lot of my job is, I'm kind of like House, you know, there's a mystery and I have to figure out what the musical mystery is and all the details and how to make that work. Saying all this has led me to the thought of, I love problem solving. I'm a musical problem solver. You know, there's some guys who do, they specify on one thing that I do, like they're a horn and string arranger, or they're a vocal arranger, or they're a music director who goes out and rehearses vocalists, or they're a conductor. I mean, I've done all these things, and I've got a certain level of ability in all of those. But I have a lot of clients, and they have something, they just don't know who else to turn to. And they come to me and they say, we know it's music and entertainment and dancers and maybe comedy, or, you know, making music fit to a certain time frame and lifting people's emotions. And we don't know exactly what it is, but, you know, somebody told us to call you. So musical problem solving. I'll give you an example. A company called Craftmade, they make kitchen cabinetry, and they would always do their awards ceremony at something called the NAHB, which is National Association of Home Builders. Imagine anything that goes into building or furnishing a house. You know, anything that you look around you and see.
Yes.
You go to this convention and there's people who sell that stuff and they're talking about the stuff. Well, one year they came to me and it was 15, 18 years ago now, but river dance was very big. You know, that Irish step dancing kind of thing. And Stomp, have you heard of that? There was a touring show with that and people would bring out trash cans and all sorts of founding. They said, we have a brilliant idea. Great, I'm ready. Let me hear it. He said, we want you to give us a 12-minute show using only things you can find in a kitchen for musical instruments, and we're going to have 12 Irish step dancers. So I kind of looked around my kitchen at the time and looked through the Craftmade catalog. Of course, they wanted me to focus on items that they had in their kitchen.
Shocking.
Yes, oddly enough. And I hired 8 percussionists who could perform live, And the producer I was working with got a hold of the dancers who did kind of the Irish tap dancing step thing. And we pre-recorded some of the elements, but we did a lot of it live. And I actually created 10 minutes of interesting music using just things you find in the kitchen. And then we supported it with some pre-recorded tracks of, you know, like Irish fiddle and boudron-style Irish drumming and stuff for the big finale. But the first 6-7 minutes of it was strictly banging on trash cans and wine bottles and spoons and washboard and hand claps and some pretty interesting stuff.
What's the worst thing about your job?
The worst thing about my job, deadlines, pressure. I work with a lot of people who figure out what they want at the 11th hour. I'm kind of the low man on the totem pole, you know, on these things. And I'll have to say, a lot of times I'm in at the top. We're the same. We have a concept for the show. We need to help. We have a 45-minute show. It needs to entertain. Here's the demographic of our audience. We throw around ideas. We want to do a show about the 1950s or the 60s or whatever. And I will help. You know, I've been on that level too. But a lot of times there's other people who do that. And right at the end, they go, oh, geez, yeah, we have music. And they'll call me and they'll say, the good news is I got 2 weeks worth of work for you. The bad news is I need it by Thursday. And that can be very stressful.
What type of person would be good at your job?
Type of person who would be good at my job, you have to be creative, and not just musically creative, but you have to be creative with deadlines. You have to be creative with dealing with people. You have to be creative with scheduling. You have to be creative with methods of delivery. You know, it used to be that I lived in Cincinnati for a while before I lived in Nashville, and I knew the guys at DHL on the dock before they would package the stuff to put it on the airplanes. It was a hub. And I made a deal with them. If I get it to them before 2 a.m., it could get to the overnight delivery. And I can't count the number of times I was racing in my car to get there before 2 a.m. trying to make a deadline. Thank goodness for PDFs and, you know, large file transfer on the computer. Now, the same thing that I would go tearing to the airport at 2 a.m., I now just hit send on my email. And so creative ways of delivering, creative ways of talking to clients, talking with the people who work for me, getting the best thing out of them. I think my sense of humor, and generally people see me as fairly easygoing and flexible.
If there is such a thing, what is a typical day like for you?
There is no typical day. It really isn't. But I should say at this point, I am married, happily married to the woman of my dreams for the last 14 years. We have two lovely daughters who are 7 and 12. And as any parent will know, and I should also add that my office is in my home and my wife's office is in the home as well. She is at this point in her career a graphic designer and internet designer. So much of my day revolves around getting up and getting my girls off to school. So depending on what I have to get out the door, sometimes it means getting up at 4:30 or 5, doing some work before my daughters get up, or planning the work I need to do for the day before my daughters get up. Sometimes it's just getting up right before they did because I stayed up almost all the night before. But it usually ends up me getting my daughters out the door. Then I come home. I'm maybe on the internet or on the phone dealing with clients or trying to get my work done. I have this what I call the golden hours between about 9 and 2. And then at 2, the circus begins again. I go pick up or drop off one of my daughters, and there's dance lessons and piano lessons and rehearsals for this and doctor's appointments for that. And my wife and I kind of equally share the burden on that. But we have two girls who go to two schools on different sides of town. And so there's this whole craziness between 2 and about 6. I generally make dinner for the family, and we get the girls to bed. And about 8 o'clock, I'll hit it again, and I will work from about 8 to midnight or 1 or 2 or 3 or, you know, depending on what the deadline is. That is one type of typical day. The other one is when I'm in the production and I go into a recording studio. I don't have a recording studio in my home like some people who do what I do. I love to rent out room and work with live people. I just really love working in the studio with live musicians rather than using the synthesizers and all that stuff. And so a day like that might be my wife is pulling more of the load of dealing with the girls that morning, and I'm out the door to a recording session, you know, working with a room full of musicians.
you don't have a studio, but is there equipment that you have to have in order to do your job?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, in this day and age, sure, absolutely. Yeah, I have a Mac, an iMac with another screen attached to it. And if you could see, there's a, you know, synthesizer style keyboard in front of me. And I have a modest amount of equipment at home that some guys, you know, much of what we do is done all on the computer. And there's some of my work that's done all on the computer. What I used to sit down at a drafting table and do with a big piece of paper and pens or pencils, you know, writing the notes out for the musicians, we now do on the computer.
That software has come a long ways since my first copy of Finale.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And I use Finale if I must, but I'm a big proponent of a program called Sibelius. As a matter of fact, if you open up Sibelius 6 or 7, the tutorial 1 score is one of my scores that Sibelius asked me to do for them. So, yeah, I spent a lot of time in Sibelius, and I spent a lot of time in Digital Performer and Pro Tools. And, you know, it's funny, when I was in college, I graduated from Towson in 1980. I never thought I'd have a computer, touch a computer, much less own one. And I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4 computers in my office right now, you know, probably 7 in the house. So, you know.
John will tell you what to do with your life right after I remind you of the good work being done by the American Red Cross. They've been doing good for a long time. When my parents were prisoners of war, one of the things that saved their lives was a package they got from the Red Cross. And somewhere in the world today, there are people you can help through the Red Cross. So do yourself a favor. Go to the American Red Cross. Go to redcross.org. So, John, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
You know, I hate vacations. But it is a good thing for me. I kick and scream to get me out of the house of motivation. Need to get away from things. I do try to. I have been trying to take a walk for about an hour a day. I try to do that in the mornings now, unless I have something hard and fast I need to get out. And I find that really helps. I meditate about 15 minutes a day, and I really find that activity helps me focus better. Motivation, boy, you know, There's two types of motivation. There's creative motivation for doing what you love, and then there's motivation of, oh my gosh, the mortgage is due type of motivation. There's two types. So it doesn't take much to look around and see my two beautiful daughters and realize what we have for the, oh my gosh, the bills have to be paid. As far as creative musical motivation, I love so many different types of music, and I'll jump on iTunes or Spotify or something, and I try to dig for some. Here's some music that I haven't heard before, you know, for motivation. I'm always reading kind of positive thinking, self-help type books. Think and Grow Rich, I'm a big fan of, and by Napoleon Hill. One that just came out recently, I believe it's called You Can Be Anything You Want by Carl Sievers, which is really good. So anyways, I try to be reading things like that, and I find that helps me. Talking with my wife, she's my best friend, and she really is good at helping me stay focused and motivated.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
I still work a fair amount as a trombone player, and I wouldn't even dare count the amount of hours I've spent with a piece of brass stuck to my face. There's some things that I've done, that I do on trombone, that I've done since I was in the, you know, eighth grade, long tones and lip slurs. Just think of them as calisthenics for horn players. And, you know, it's funny. There's been times when I literally have not played in my career that I've not been able to play trombone for months. But anymore, I try to play trombone some every day, and it's therapeutic to me now. At this point in my life, you know, it's my touchstone. It's something I've done even if I don't have a gig coming up, a recording session I have to play on or something, you know, The moving of that air and things just does something to calm me down.
Mm-hmm. Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Yes. When I collapsed my lung in college, we spoke about that earlier. That was probably a real turning point, because my mother was like, oh, you got to quit playing trombone. And, you know, there was talk about they might have to remove a lung. And I told her, well, I know the tuba player in the Chicago Symphony only has one lung, and I'm going to, you know, well, what, you know. And that was a real turning point. But, you know, the doctors assured me, my mother, and especially myself, no, once he goes through this operation, you know, he should be able to play trombone his left lung should be fine, but his right lung could collapse at any time without notice. But after I hadn't been playing for about 5 or 6 months, I'd just been playing again for a week, and a friend of mine called me, and he said, "Hey, man, I took this summer job," and he was like a theater tech type of guy, you know, lighting backstage, that kind of guy. He said, "Listen, I'm doing this job down here as a tech supervisor, and they had a trombone player in the show down here that they had hired via auditions, and he quit like right before they're supposed to start rehearsals. They start rehearsals in 2 days. Do you want a summer job? Can you be down here?" And he knew my situation and didn't say to them, you know, that, well, he's been off of his trombone for 5 months, but he knew I was a pretty good musician. And I said, "Absolutely." I went down there, and that job changed my life. That job working at King's Dominion as a trombone player, playing for some big stars, I might add. My first gig was for Fred Flintstone and Scooby-Doo. So playing in Fred's band was my first big break. But that, I can trace almost every job I get, two or three connections back to that job.
Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through all of your challenges?
You know, my mother always used to say when I get down, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, and my dear mother has passed away several years ago now, but I still think of that when everything gets, she said, pick yourself up by your bootstraps. My dad was the comedian, my cheerleader and everything. My mother was the quiet one who'd say one joke a week that would lay us all out. She was very funny in her own life, but she was the very, you know, your typical kind of that New England stock that you hear so much about. You just keep moving on no matter what. You know, she'd say, don't sweat the small stuff, and it's all small stuff.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
Well, you know, you had sent me an email in advance and warned me about this. So I'm a big fan of the David Letterman show and his band especially. And I love his top 10 list. And I have 10 points, and these aren't in any particular order. So don't expect to be a singer at the end, because I didn't really do that. But I'm going to give you 10 points. And I would give this to anybody pretty much in any profession, especially in what I do. Number one is always have a plan, but be flexible. I wish I'd followed this more in my past, having a plan, because I did wander at times in my career. But if you have a plan, you tend to get more done. Number two is, this is a quote from my high school band director, Tony Hyde. He said, "You will learn more in your first 30 minutes on the street than the whole previous 4 years you spent in college." And he was so right. I think you should consider college as preparing your toolbox. Putting all your hammers and saws and everything in your toolbox, but you're going to learn more about fixing that first railing on the porch with that toolbox. You know, you really do the things that you learn on the street. And it goes back to what I talked about, you know, being flexible, mm-hmm. and being adaptable. Third is a quote that I literally wrote on a piece of paper when I think I was 10 or 12 years old. I was watching, I think probably Merv Griffin or something, and an old actress named Kay Starr, who seemed particularly ancient to me back then. She was probably 40. But anyway, she said, she was asked that question, what would be your advice? And she said, "You'll meet the same people on the way up as you'll meet on the way down." And that to me means be kind, be empathetic. You know, the person who is your costumer, who washes your dirty costume if you're in a show, or who's moving that set piece, or the person who's working the security gate where you might be, you never know where that person is going to be 10 years from now. I get work from people I know who are in jobs that you might consider, you know, kind of the lower jobs in show business, but they stuck around and they ended up in management. I mean, there's that side, there's that facet to it. But the other facet is, you know, just be kind, be empathetic to everybody around you. Everybody has a job to do. Everybody has their own life story. But, you know, you're going to, you know, it's the karma thing goes around. Number four is always learn something new, which is kind of self-explanatory. You've got to keep reading and researching and learning new things about your business. Five, concentrate on the positive in any situation you're in, those around you, and especially yourself. You should never be harder on yourself than your enemy. You know, I mean, that is the worst thing. Just concentrate on what's positive about a situation, and it's going to see you through. Number six, find one aspect of your profession and absolutely master it. If it's a piece of software, I know Sibelius really well, like a ninja, and I know Finale pretty well too. music notation is a facet of what I do that I know better than 99% of the people I run into. And you'd be amazed at the doors it has opened for me. I get known as the guy that people, you know, name people you will have heard of will call me and ask me for advice on the software. And it leads to good relationships and to me being able to help people, which leads to other type of work that I love to do. Number seven, every day is simultaneously the show you've prepared for in the past and the dress rehearsal for tomorrow. You know, every day you're just going to do the best you can with what you do and do the best, you know, no matter what it is. But, you know, you're always preparing to be a little better for it for tomorrow. Number eight, always seek out people more talented than yourself to work with. Always surround yourself with people more talented than yourself, and always learn from them. Nine, this is a quote from a Paul Schaefer, a book on the keyboard, Paul Schaefer, the guy who plays for David Letterman, a book of his I just read, and he calls it the pressure of time. And I say, welcome the pressure of time. Realize deadlines are a part of life. Find a way to ride on them like a surfer rides a wave, and don't let them paralyze you. Mm-hmm. The stress of it can literally kill you, but it's a fact of life, and learn some techniques to deal with the pressure of time, because those people are usually the most successful, at least in my business. And number 10, I'm going to preface it because it sounds a little weird, but it's all just tongue and blow, kid. My trombone teacher, John Coffey, rest his soul, one of my great influences. I dearly loved him. But in our trombone lessons, you know, he talked about the technical aspects of this and that. And in the end, he said, it's all just tongue and blow, kid. You just put the horn up to your face and the tongue starts the airflow and you let the air go through the horn. You can talk about all of the other technical aspects, but at the end of the day, you know, just play with that joy. Just get out there and just let it go. Don't worry about the details. I had another trombone teacher who used to tell me, he said, when you go up on stage to perform, forget about me, forget about Philadelphia. He happened to be in Philadelphia. He said, forget about everything I told you. Just do it. Just go out there and do it. And I think when you're doing your job, you know, at a certain point, you just have to just do it. Let your inner self go and just do it. Prepare. Absolutely prepare. But, you know, when you perform, whether it's on stage or any job, when I get up in front of students I do some teaching. When I get in front of students to teach or to talk, or when I'm dealing with clients in a business meeting, I forget about all those details, those books I read, and, you know, how to influence this or how to make a deal, whatever. I go with my gut. I really do, you know. So, and that would be it.
My last question is, help me get better at this process. Think of an event in your life or a story that you haven't told, or something you wanted to say that we haven't given an opportunity to. What question should I have asked you to get you to tell me that story?
I think maybe you might ask, especially at this point, and by the way, I'll say that I'm 53. At this point in my life, some of those things I just told you, what do you wish you knew when you were 18 that you know now? And there's definitely some things on that list that if I could get in a time machine and go back and tell myself, you know, maybe that's a question. If you can get in a time machine and go back to when you're 18, what would you tell yourself, you know, that you think would maybe improve your life or bring more joy to your life at this point in your career or your life? And there are definitely some things that if I had the time machine, I would go back. And
so, John, if you had a time machine and you could go back, what would you tell yourself when you were 18?
I would tell myself, be a lot easier on yourself. You know, love yourself more. I went through some times when I was very, very hard myself. And I could get depressed at the drop of a hat. And whatever I did, I felt was not good enough. That really held me back sometimes, you know. And the whole tongue and blow thing, you know, with John Coffey, I think he was trying to tell me that in his own way. And I didn't get quite that facet of it, you know. You just got to go up and be and do who you are at that moment in time and love yourself for it and realize that, you know, what you may be not perfect by some form of measurement, but, you know, it's as perfect as it can possibly be at that point in your journey. And you should love the fact that you are at that point in your journey and you are as perfect as you can be at that point in your journey.
I want to thank John Hitchie for joining me today. Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Ken. I enjoyed talking to you.